Tenant business. Oops, no, you're not. Well, we got to find out where I am. You're in the Senate Education Workforce Committee. Welcome this afternoon. I'm so excited. We have a great presentation this afternoon from the Department of State Lands, and I want you to know, colleagues, that I've been reading a thesis that was written in June of 1949 by a University of Oregon graduate student, Norman Ray Hawk. A History of the Irreducible School Fund in Oregon. This is a fascinating piece of literature. I mean, history and just, I mean, we're going to hear a lot about that from the department here in a few minutes, but if any of you want a copy of this, let me know. It's just fascinating to read about what Oregon did with its common school fund land, what the federal government did to us, what we did to ourselves, and how we have missing land and why it is that the federal government ended up owing us 5,200 acres as of 1992, and we still don't have all of it in our possession. So we're going to learn all about that today.
Madam Chair, you need to get out more.
I know. I know. I've been reading this in bed at night and in the car and you driving back and forth. I'm not driving. I'm the passenger, but it is just great reading. I love it. And this student, I'll have to look up to see if he's still living because he did a great job on this. All right. So if you have cell phones, please turn them on. Vibrate, and if you're here to sign up for a hearing, those sign-up sheets are on the right. And Ms. Hannis, why don't you introduce yourself and who you're with and get started on our presentation.
Thank you, Senator. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ann Hannis, Director of Department of State Lands. I'd also like to introduce Steve Purchase, who's the Assistant Director at the Department of State Lands, and he's in charge of field operations and land management. Also, following my presentation, there will be a panel of the Common School Fund representatives of Common School Fund beneficiaries to talk also about the Common School Fund.
Great. And Ms. Hannis, before you start, I want to let folks know that this is going to take us up to 4 o'clock, probably till 4:05, since we got started a little bit late. So if any of you are here for the other bills, that's sort of our schedule. Not sort of; it is our schedule. All right. So take it away. And
great.
Do you want to turn dim the lights a bit?
Well, my presentation is going to be focused on the Common School Fund, what it is, and the history of the Common School Fund, and then I'll also talk about initiatives that we're going to be taking to try to boost the Common School Fund. The mission of our agency is to ensure a legacy for Oregonians and their public schools through sound stewardship of lands, wetlands, waterways, unclaimed property, and the Common School Fund. We serve as the administrative arm of the land board, and the land board is a constitutionally designated board. It consists of the governor, the treasurer, and the secretary of state. DSL is one of the oldest state agencies. We were established back in 1878 as a clerk of the land board. We manage common school fund assets. Those are land and waterways that were granted at statehood in 1859. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. Unclaimed property and estates. Those and estates, by that I mean estates with no heirs or wills. We also protect and conserve state waterways and wetlands. We manage the South Sioux National Estuary and Reserve, and we also deal with the Natural Heritage Advisory Council. According to Oregon's Constitution, the land board manages the common school fund lands to benefit schools, and this is quoting from the Constitution, consistent with the conservation of this resource under sound techniques of land management. Now, this was followed up by an attorney general opinion called the Crookham opinion that was issued, I believe, in 1992. And under that opinion, it said that management responsibilities require that the land board obtain full market value from the sale, rental, or other use of Admission Act lands while conserving the corpus of the trust. The Common School Fund is a permanent trust fund. In fact, originally it was called the Irreducible School Trust Fund. And it is a permanent trust to benefit current and future generations of public school kids from grades K through 12. And our agency programs contribute to the Common School Fund. Now let me get into the history of the Common School Fund. The whole idea of setting aside land for the benefit of the schools really dated back to King Henry VIII, and this was when King Henry VIII took over the church lands. and it was a church that provided the education for schools. That sent things in disarray in England, and what they did was then use the church lands as an endowment for the schools and to teach children that didn't have the means to pay for schools. Well, our forefathers borrowed that concept, and beginning with the establishment of the state of Ohio, each state received land grants to fund schools. This was at a time when our country was land rich and cash poor, and they were really looking for a way to encourage settlement as well as to be able to fund the schools. Oregon, in Ohio, they were given one section. In Oregon, we were given two sections out of every township, the 16th and 36th sections. Originally, that was about 6% of our land base, or about 3.4 million acres. Today, we only have about a quarter of that original grant, and I'll get into why that happened in just a bit. But the proceeds of the Common School Fund are used for education. They're distributed on a twice annual basis. And these lands are commonly referred to as school lands or trust lands. Now, getting into the history of the Common School Fund, the lands were sold quickly into private ownership. I think there was a strong belief that it was best to get the lands into private ownership for generating taxes, for purposes of economic development, and to encourage settlement. And the economic benefits would be greater than if left in public ownership. Unfortunately, a large portion of Oregon's lands were lost through fraud by swindlers and land speculators. In fact, if you'd like some more bedtime reading, there was a book that was written by Stephen Pewter. It was called Looters of the Public Domain. He wrote it from his Multnomah County jail cell, where he was being jailed as a result of his conviction connected with the land frauds. He was one of the perpetrators and was upset with his cohort who deserted him and refused to pay for his bail at the time, and so he decided to write an expose of all the actions that had occurred regarding those land frauds. Many of the land frauds, some of the most interesting ones that I thought were would be if you could get state land for about half the price of what you'd get federal lands. Federal land at the time went for about $2.50 an acre, and state land went for $1.25. So if you could try to figure out how to get it as a state land, which made the state school fund lands a particular target, people tried to do that. There was an awful lot of forgery, but there also were methods that went on. For example, as people were trying to get forest land that was very valuable, if you could claim 160 acres and you can get a number of people to claim 160 acres, the way for homestead purposes, they would take a crate, put it out on the land, attack some shingles on it, and call it a shelter or a home. And then they were able to claim it as 160 acres. Or if you could claim swamp land, you could get it for a fraction of the price. And the way you claimed swamp land was by saying that you took a boat across it. Well, if you found a disreputable land commissioner and loaded a boat on a wagon and hauled it across the land, you could then claim it as swamp land. And there were a number of other schemes having to do with, particularly in lieu lands. In lieu lands were those lands that the state had that when the 16th and 36th sections were granted to the state, they many of those sections were occupied by settlers, and so the state was given basically an IOU, or they were called in lieus, to be claimed elsewhere. And people used those in lieu lands then to be able to get certificates to claim land elsewhere. And many a times the state never saw the money going into its coffers for the benefit of the state.
And Ms. Hannes, from my reading, and I'm just getting into the fraud part, and I'm so excited about it, but I recall you telling me in my office that there were 30 politicians and one U.S. senator who went to jail over this big fraud scheme.
That's correct. About the first 50, 60 years, unfortunately, corruption was really extensive in Oregon, and that culminated with investigations in early 1900. Well, there were state investigations in 1872, 1878, and 1876. The land fraud trials didn't begin until around 1902 to 1905 and ended in 1913, so they were covered a fairly lengthy period of time.
There are a couple ahead, I think.
Yeah.
Just for the record, none of those people are still serving, Madam Chair.
In 1902, the federal government investigated those land frauds, and as I mentioned, that continued until 1913. There were about, I believe, about 20 to 30 public officials that went to jail at the time, including U.S. Senator John Mitchell, I believe the state forest superintendent, land commissioner at the time, several legislators, and other officials. And as a result of that, we really ended up with about one quarter of the lands that were originally given to us. So it was unfortunately a black mark in Oregon's history. But we still do have a quarter of those lands left, and I'd like to talk about what we have in the Common School Fund and then management of those lands today.
And Ms. Hannes, one of the other things that I read, too, was that they would sell land to people without any money down, and then those people would have the land for a long period of time, and because the land office was so backed up and the surveys weren't all done, then by the time they got around to it, the people didn't want the land anymore, so they basically lived there for free and gave the land back. And
that's true. Or at the time, you know, when you did exchanges, the exchanges were made on an acre-by-acre basis. So if you go in there, and many of the land had very valuable timber, and so the timber was cut,
mm-hmm.
and then the cut-over timber land was then exchanged for other, you know, land with timber on it. Now, I don't want to say that, you know, all land transactions at the time were fraud by any means, but it did particularly hit the Common School Fund lands very hard.
Well, and from this thesis, Oregon didn't do a very good job at managing what lands they had, and there was concern that, you know, the federal government wasn't being fair with us and wasn't completing the survey quickly. But there were other states in the same boat as us, Minnesota, who managed their lands very well, and they have significant land and money built up because of that good management.
And that's true. At the time, survey techniques were not precise by any means, and it was very difficult to survey in Oregon with the geography we had. But also, it was underfunded for surveying, and people were not, sometimes they weren't always the most reputable ones that were surveying as well. So a combination of those factors meant that oftentimes people didn't know where their land went. And that was a source of a lot of frustration, not just with the Common School Fund lands, but people that own their lands. And it took a number of years for people to be able to straighten out to know exactly if they own their lands or not, because oftentimes a settler would come in and they wouldn't know it was a 36 or 16th mm-hmm. section. And so there were laws that were enacted, a series of laws that were enacted at the time to try to clear that up. Unfortunately, there were also major corruption problems going on the federal level. If you kind of remember history of that time from about the 1870s to, you know, early 1900s, there were a lot of scandals on the federal side and the state side. And so it was that interplay of laws between the federal and the state that resulted in some of the abuses of land management at the time.
All right, thank you. I'll let you continue. I'm just so excited about what I learned in this book.
There were a number of changes with the Common School Fund, but one of the profound changes that happened in terms of the management of the investments of the fund occurred in the late 1980s. And it was at that time in 1988 that there was a constitutional amendment that allowed investment of the Common School Fund in the stock market. And that really caught, you know, the wave of the rise of the stock market. It couldn't have been more perfect timing. And Oregon's school fund was the envy of, you know, many other states because we were able to have that management of the fund split between stocks and bonds. 1997, the legislature increased the cap. At first, it was 50% stocks, 50% bonds, and now it's about 70-30, 70% in stocks, 70% in bonds. And that was very, very timely. And from in 1989, the Common School Fund was a little less than $200 million. Today, it stands at around $900 million. Now, what I'm saying in terms of the value of the Common School Fund, it's important to understand that we have the Common School Fund that we talk about that's invested by the Treasurer and the Oregon Investment Council, and then we have the Common School Fund lands. So the entire, the fund plus the lands make up the Common School Fund portfolio of investments. This shows, it portrays how the Common School Fund works. If you look in the upper left-hand corner, the constitutional revenue, that's the lands that flow from that original Admissions Act grant, flows into the Common School Fund and builds up the principal. On the right-hand, upper right-hand side is the statutory revenue that flows into the Common School Fund. Those are, that's revenue such as waterway leases and also unclaimed property that flows in there. And then it is the investment earnings that's distributed semi-annually to schools, and that's what's shown in that bottom part with the flow out of the earnings. And then the agency takes its expenses from the revenues, as well as a portion of the earnings. I mentioned that the state treasurer and the Oregon Investment Council invest the fund. The values of the fund over the last about 4 years have ranged from a low of around $600 million that occurred just after 9/11 to a high of $911 million, which was the end of December. Today, it's just at $899 million. The state land board sets the policy, which is based on a change in the valuation and a sliding scale formula. This next chart shows the distribution of schools over the last, since 1990. From about 1990 until 1999, the land board generally distributed about $10 to $15 million per year. It was in 1999-2000 that the land board instituted a new distribution policy that really resulted in a jump up. And that, I think, was in recognition that land board saw that the fund had grown significantly, could send out a greater proportion out to the schools than had been building up over time. The area that shaded in year 2003, that is the statutory revenue that was sent out to schools in a special distribution. That represented 50 years of accumulation of statutory revenues, and it was used during 2003 to help plug the budget hole at the time. The distribution policy was just recently changed just at the last land board meeting. Instead of making the distribution based on the year-over-year change, which ended up introducing a lot of volatility into the distribution to schools, the land board went to a three-year rolling average using the most recent three-year average to the 3 years before that. It goes from a minimum distribution of 2% all the way up to a maximum distribution of 5%. The distributions, as I mentioned, have fluctuated. They've gone between 9 to 41 million. I mentioned the one-time supplemental distribution of around $18 million in December 2002. I'm pleased, though, in the last year, we've sent out $20.1 million in December of 2004 and June of 2005. And then December of 2005 and June of 2006, that's even going to go higher to $22.8 million for each of those times. And that's a 13% increase. And that really, I'm pleased to say, is as a result of the increase in the stock market as well as revenues going into the fund that have pushed up the value of the fund. So where does the money come from? All of the resources and related income from the trust lands benefit the common school fund. This includes state timber sales and grazing leases. I'll show you a map in just a second that illustrates the different types of activities we get into. Land sales and easements. The land board just agreed to sell 13 parcels of isolated land. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. We also get leases from submerged and submersible lands, permit fees, fines. We get revenue from estates with no wills or heirs. These are individuals that that have no will or heirs. It's actually one of the reasons why Oregon came together to try to form a statehood, because they were trying to decide and resolve a dispute about an inheritance, as well as unclaimed property funds and proceeds.
Ms. Hannes, which permit fees and fines do you get? Do you get all of them?
Most of that, the permit fees are primarily from the removal fill program.
The removal fill program?
Right, okay. That's a regulatory program. This map highlights the kind of land management activities that we get into, ranging from, if you go up, for example, into the Portland area and you see houseboats and marinas up there, we collect a lease from those houseboats and marinas. We also receive royalties from gravel extraction and state-owned streams. We have received revenue from fiber optic cables coming over from the across the seas, because that comes over on state-owned land. We also manage the 3 miles out of the territorial seas in addition to the other lands we manage. And that's one of the reasons why we dealt with the New Carissa shipwreck, because it was on state-owned land.
So the wave energy project they want to build in Reedsport, which will go 3 miles out, you will probably get some kind of fee from use of the ocean floor there?
That's correct. We would get a royalty from that.
Oh, and if we hit big on that invention, we're going to do well.
Right. So that would be helpful. The Elliott State Forest is the largest block of state forest land that is owned as part of the Common School Fund, although we have other scattered tracts around the state. The Elliott State Forest is managed by this Department of Forestry under contract to the Land Board and the Department of State Lands. We also own the building in which DSL is located, and we rent out the space in the upper two floors to, like, Department of Economic Development and OWEB and Employment. We have rangelands in eastern Oregon. Those are some of our largest blocks of land, so we receive grazing fees from that. Communication sites, if there's a cell phone tower or radio tower on state lands, if you ever want to take a hike up to the top of Steens Mountain, you'll see radio and cell phone towers up there, and we collect a lease from that. If you drive up I-84 toward eastern Oregon, you'll see those poplar plantations. Some of those lands are common school fund lands, and we get revenue from that. So there's a wide range, and we're also looking for other possible uses on state lands, such as wind generation, and I'll talk about some of the things that we're going to be trying to do with our in-lieu lands.
And weren't you telling me that Arizona, for instance, built a resort or some development on some land, and they're making pretty good money on that?
Exactly. Some of the other states have become much more aggressive in terms of their land management, and that's something we're really looking into that we'd like to do on some of the in-lieu selections that we've targeted that are going to be in central Oregon. And in Arizona, for example, they still retain many of their lands. They got 4 sections out of every township.
Hey. And did they come along later than we did?
They came along later, but also their lands were considered to be less valuable than Oregon's lands, and thus, like Utah and Arizona, were given 4 sections out of every township. But some of those lands, for example, now border the northern part of Phoenix, and the state there has leased out those lands, so they've built an upscale shopping mall, a Marriott resort, light industrial, and residential. And except for the residential, they lease out the land, and then the payments of those lease payments then come into the common school fund. And it's going to amount in millions of dollars coming into their common school fund. And Montana and Utah have also, and Colorado have also become more aggressive that way in leasing out their lands for commercial development.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Do they have water rights in Arizona along with the land?
Chair Walker.
Do we have water rights in Oregon?
We have water rights connected with our lands. Right, we
so
do.
They can be very valuable.
They can be very valuable, yeah. Yes.
Madam Chair, in Arizona they buy most of their water.
What? I'm sorry, sir?
In Arizona they purchase water. They don't have any.
Well, subterranean water they have.
But for the agribusiness that's growing up there, it's all purchased.
May I clarify the question, please?
Yes, you may.
There is a large subterranean reservoir that they are drawing on, I understand. I don't know who has the water rights to the reservoir. It should go with the land above it, I would think. And they've shut down some farming in Arizona to sell the water rights to the cities.
I don't know. Let me see if Steve knows the answer.
It's no pressing. But
okay.
I think water rights are something that can be very valuable.
They can be, yes. Very much so. This map here highlights where our state ownership is. You can see the large block of near Coos Bay. That's the Elliott State Forest. The blocks that are in southeastern Oregon represent many of the rangelands we have. And I know it's difficult to see, but there's scattered little tracks all over the state, ranging in various sizes.
So where would you say the bulk of our lands are located?
The bulk of the lands would be the rangelands in southeastern Oregon.
And we lease those out to ranchers?
We lease those out to ranchers. We may also lease them for other purposes, such as communication sites. We're exploring, are any of those tracts of land could be valuable for wind generation or any other sources that we might have. We had some interest in some land down Lakeview that may arise, depending on how the energy prices are, in geothermal, that could have a potential for the Common School Fund.
Well, that is, I serve on the Western Governors Association Clean and Diversified Energy Committee. It's a long name, but geothermal is one of the task forces, and we discuss the geothermal sites in Oregon. So,
and we have some, we still have some areas that could be potentially very valuable, including in southeast Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Great, yes.
The blue area, that's a 3-mile limit, is it?
That's correct.
Now, it's a valuable fishery. For instance, scallops were harvested in the early 1980s by ships coming all the way from the East Coast to do that harvest. There's shrimp. We get a licensing. There are lots of crabs that are taken in that area.
Chair Walker, Senator Morse, no, we don't get any royalty from the fish. We used to get that for oysters, but that was transferred over to the Department of Agriculture maybe 15, 20 years ago.
That's strange that we are not taking advantage of the natural resources on those lands. That's mm-hmm. where the crab hang out. Okay, thank
okay.
you.
This summarizes the acreage that we have in land management of our forest land. As I mentioned, the largest block is rangeland there, as well as 800,000 acres of waterways and territorial seas. I should mention that we also own mineral rights, including exploration and production leases, and we've had interest in coal bed methane. We also own, we lease out a kitty litter mine, we call it, the diatomaceous earth down in Malheur County. So a whole range of different things.
We're in the market of kitty litter.
Three cats. Oh, I'm really interested.
To buy a lot of kitty litter, yeah. Okay.
That's funny.
Submerged and submersible lands. These are lands that are in state waterways that are state ownership. We have about 400 waterway leases, and this is around the state. Where it is state-owned land, including dock registration, easements, and sand and gravel. I mentioned on forest lands, we contract with the Oregon Department of Forestry for management of the lands. This is about 133,000 acres, with the primary tract being the Elliott State Forest. And this brings in about $22 million over the biennium. I should also note that at the request of the legislature, there was a cost-benefit study done on whether or not to own or to sell the Elliott. Mason, Bruce, and Gerard conducted the study, and I believe that the results of that were handed out to legislators. What they found is that the forest was valued somewhere between $265 to $489 million. They looked at four potential types of buyers. The bottom line was they thought that the state would either realize a $136 million loss or up to about a $200 million gain, depending on who purchased the forest and what it ended up being valued at.
And I'd say, Madam Chair, that maybe 10 years ago it would have been a whole different scale. I mean, you got to go by markets and various other things, but. That's off the subject.
All right. But for the time being, we're going to still make our $22 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
South Slough Reserve, I'll just quickly talk about this. This is about 4,800 acres. It's located just south of Coos Bay. It was one of the first national estuaries in the country. We get about 25,000 visitors, and about 6,000 of those are students. It's managed for research and education and restoration. It's really been an important laboratory, outdoor laboratory for schools, and there's been an outreach to schools like through an interactive web broadcast that was done last fall, for example. Unclaimed property. Under Oregon's Unclaimed Property Act, Oregon DSL is the trust holder of abandoned funds when the rightful owner can't be found. These are like paychecks or unclaimed safety deposit boxes, for example. We search for the rightful owner, but until that owner is found and in perpetuity, the unclaimed property is held in the Common School Fund. This amounts to about $180 million, and the earnings of which are distributed to schools. I'd urge you to check our website, little plug here, www.oregonstatelands.us, to see if you might have money coming to you. You might be surprised.
$100 million.
It ranges from just a small amount to a large amount. So you have a better chance of getting money here than the lottery, I might add. So.
Probably true. And Ms. Hannes, how long do you hold the unclaimed property before it becomes property of the state?
Actually, it's held in perpetuity. So
We just earn the interest.
And that was as a result of basically a agreement that was held among the 50 states so that, you know, some states didn't escheat it earlier, and we may hold money for somebody in Nebraska or Washington, and likewise. So it ensures the rights of the citizens throughout the states.
So what is the oldest money that we've been holding on? How far back do we go?
Pretty far back. I don't know.
So we'll just keep rolling it over?
We keep rolling it over, and that has, you know, built up, and that keeps building up over time.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not a small amount of money. That can be about $20 million over the biennium.
Of revenue?
Of receipts coming into the Common School Fund.
Great.
The next part is estate administration. This is estates with no will or heir. We search for the heirs. We inventory. We get maybe about 125 cases over the biennium. Half of those have heirs and half of them don't. We auction off the property after 10 years. If the heirs are not found, then it does become the property of the Common School Fund. And to date, we've gotten about $1.2 million from that.
Senator Cruz?
Okay. You go through the first two bullets, and then after 10 years, they become part of the school fund, so they're not part of that separate in perpetuity block.
They're not part of that in perpetuity, because actually escheated estates are constitutionally designated to the Common School Fund. So after 10 years, if an heir doesn't come forward or we can't find one, then it is the property of the Common School Fund.
So we got less time on that one, Senator Deckard, so we better move quicker.
I'm in.
Another program of the Commons, of the Department of State Lands is the Removal Fill Program. This really dates back to when, because of the ownership of state waterways, it used to be that, you know, any fill and removal of state waterways used to come to the land board. If you look in the old land board minutes, they wrestled over all these different fills and removals. And that then was changed into a regulatory program, which is now the Removal Fill Program. And the purpose of that is to conserve the waters of the state, protect navigation, fishery, ensure that activities of one landowner don't adversely affect another, and to minimize flooding, improve water quality, and provide fish and wildlife habitat. Let me go over the major common school fund issues that we're facing. One, we want to increase the long-term returns to the common school fund. My hope is, and I'll talk about that in a minute, is to try to double the value of the common school fund over the next 7 to 10 years. You know, we're at $900 million, and I'm an economist, so I look at things that way. And if you look at the power of compounding, earning an expected rate of interest of about 7% a year, that will mean that it would double in about 7 to 10 years. Hazardous waste cleanup is one that worries us because we're involved with the Portland Harbor owning the bed in the banks of the river there, and we're having to be involved with that to make sure that we limit the state's liability, particularly for the Common School Fund. Elliott State Forest Management Plan is under development. That should be completed in the next year, but that will determine what the harvest level and the management of that forest will be. It's looking like that management plan may actually be able to bump up the harvest just a little bit, so it'll return more to the Common School Fund. Grazing fees, there was an audit that was done by the Secretary of State on grazing fees to look at what should be the appropriate fair market value of the grazing fees. We are now, we formed a grazing fee advisory committee that includes representatives of from the lessees, the counties, and beneficiaries, and they're currently going through that. I hope that they'll have a recommendation to us by early summer. Our asset management plan. This is our plan that was first done back in, I believe, 1995 or 96. It was the first of its kind among all the states to look at how should we manage our portfolio of real estate. What should we retain? What should we sell? We're updating that now. We're working with consultants and doing appraisals of our land, and this is going to guide us in the future for how we best manage and maximize value off of the land. In lieu lands, we have sent a letter to BLM. We've identified lands that we want to claim to get our debt fulfilled of the 3,200 remaining acres that are owed to the state. We are targeting lands that we believe would be a high value to the Common School Fund, and these are lands primarily in Central Oregon that we hope we will be able to develop.
And Ms. Hannis, let's spend just a moment on that. Mm-hmm. From my information that you gave me, that's not in the 1949 thesis, the court, I'm not sure which, not clear which court, but a court ruled that Oregon was owed approximately 5,200 acres by the federal government. So you've negotiated some of that. So since 1992 to 2005, why is it taking so long? Why is the federal government so slow? And where are we at in that process?
One, we did claim some land in 1992.
Court case? How did that? What's this?
Let me have Steve Purchase come up because he's most familiar with the court case, and he can tell you about
that. Okay, if you could state your name, please, because this is really important for me to understand why it went to court and why it's taken so darn long to get our land and why we're not getting any interest on it.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Steve Purchase, Assistant Director, Department of State Lands. Let me see if I can try to answer your question. We entered into litigation with the Bureau of Land Management for the purpose of settling the federal land debt, school emissions back land debt that was owed the state back in the 1960s. Through that point of discussion, we actually wound up going to court with the federal government. It took 9 years to complete the court case. During that 9 years, there was a lot of discussion back and forth about what was actually owed the state and what was not owed the state. We did get, the court case was the BLM versus the state of Oregon, Department of State Lands, Division of State Lands, as we were known at the time. When that court ruling came out, the federal government acknowledged the fact that they owed the state 5,200 acres. Of that 5,200 acres, we owed about 2,200 acres of that to other parties. Ann mentioned earlier that we had some fraud cases in the history of the state. We had sold land that we did not have clear title to back in the 1920s and 1918s in those arenas. We had to clear those fraudulent land sales up. We have one remaining sale to clear up. It's 167 acres. That's to a third party. We have made that selection as well with the BLM. The rest of the lands, the 3,200 acres, we did select 640 acres southeast of Bend. That took about 4.5 years to complete. That's been done, and we've recently made our selections for the remaining number of acres. As to why we're not getting interest on that land, part of the litigation was that the state was owed certain acres, but that's all we were owed.
Oh. Because the federal government said so?
Well, because the judge said so.
Well, those activist judges, you know, I've heard that before. But all right, well, I'm disappointed that we didn't get interest on land that's been owed to us since time
began. Madam Chair, I think the agencies say we're equally share your concerns there.
I would think so. So now, after we paid back the other people, did we? When we paid back the other people, we didn't give them interest, did we?
No, we did not.
Good. Okay, so 3,200 acres are left, and we are now negotiating with BLM to get those lands. And primarily, you're negotiating for land in Central Oregon and Deschutes County. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. What we did is way back in the early 1990s, when we realized this court case was finally going to come to an end, we started to look through all of the lands that were available to the state for selection. The Bureau of Land Management only allows the state to select certain lands, and those lands are what they consider to be public domain lands. So it'll be lands that are not dedicated for other purposes. So as we looked at all the public domain lands within the state, very quickly we were able to recognize that some of the lands we just simply did not want. So as we narrowed down our list, made our selections for the folks that we owed land to, because that was our first priority, is to get those folks taken care of, make their titles whole. We completed that work and then took the remaining lands that we would want to look at to do our selections. In the one case where we still owe 167 acres, that individual did not want to have Central Oregon land, but wanted land on the west side, wanted west side forest land. So that has taken us a little bit longer to work with the Bureau of Land Management to identify that exact parcel of land. When the state makes a selection, the federal government has to go through a planning process to release that land. And as you can imagine, going through the NEPA process, environmental impact process, all the things that the federal government must do to manage its land, it takes some time to get through that process. We started looking at land in Central Oregon back in the mid-1990s because we recognized back then that the Deschutes County area was very fast-growing. The communities of Bend and Redmond were obviously going to experience some tremendous growth. And we have made our selections in lands around Bend and Redmond. We have a 640-acre section at the Deschutes Market Road, about 800 acres south and west of the Pronghorn development, and 1,740 acres at Klein View, right adjacent to the Eagle Crest development. And we did that because we're pretty convinced that that growth will occur, their resorts are going to expand, the cities are probably going to grow together over time, much like Salem, Kaiser, Springfield, Eugene, that we have positioned ourselves to take advantage of that growth. When it occurs here in the very near future.
And you expect to have the balance of the 3,200 acres resolved by when?
Madam Chair, I would expect it to take us about 2 more years.
2 more years, okay.
The Bureau of Land Management went through a very extensive land management process and planning for the Upper Deschutes lands that we've looked at.
Mm-hmm.
And in that plan, they identified some lands that they wanted us to take. Of course, we chose not to take those lands they wanted us to take. So they're going to have to go back and amend their plan to accommodate our needs. Back in the early 90s, when this lawsuit was resolved, we signed an agreement with the Bureau of Land Management that in any planning effort that the Bureau of Land Management did, they would come back to us and work with us on their plan to identify any in lieu land selections that we would be interested in. In this particular case, that didn't happen, and it was unfortunate, but it just didn't happen. So we have met with them. We've worked through some of the issues with them. We are reevaluating the 800 acres south and east of Pronghorn to see if there are some additional lands within the community expansion areas that we may be interested in, simply because of some market potential that's come about in the last year or so. So the plan, the BLM plan, is to finalize their planning document by July. Once their planning document is completed, any of the lands identified for immediate disposal would come to us probably this year. That's what they call their Z3 lands. Lands that they want to retain, Z1s, or lands that are available to sell or exchange with other public entities, Z2 lands. Z2 lands can be dealt with under the current plan. Any Z1 lands would have to be replanted, if you will, to allow those to be released to the state. But the state office of BLM has made every assurance to us that they will, in fact, reamend their plan to accommodate our land selections. I think there is interest. The state director and Ann have met on a couple occasions and have agreed that this is a high priority for the BLM as well as us. I think we're going to get it done. It's just going to take some time to go through that planning process.
Well, I thank you for that little tutorial on that, and I'm hoping that we can get this information out to the public, to Oregonians, to let them know what we're trying to do, sort of put the squeeze on BLM to move forward in that process a little faster than they are.
And we are, I should say, you know, we are pleased that they have put this as a high priority. It does take a little bit of time to work it through. And actually, given that the average sale time for a BLM parcel is often 5 to 7 years, this, I hate to say 2 years is almost lightning speed for a federal agency.
Okay, great. Well, I've asked so many darn questions that we're running short on time, so Ms. Hannis, if you can kind of finish
quickly
up,
through the rest.
Because we've got some folks who wanted to testify. Thank you, Mr. Purchase.
Ballot Measure 37 is an area that's uncertain, particularly with regard to our removal fill program. And also with regard to the removal fill program, we have submitted in a bill for a fee increase because the fees now cover less than 20% of the cost of the program. There hasn't been a fee increase since 89, and so this would bring in more revenue for the Common School Fund. Initiatives to boost that I mentioned several of these, but one of the things I do want to mention is proposal that you'll be seeing legislation soon to transfer unclaimed property to the Treasurer office. About 30 states do have the unclaimed program in the Treasurer's office. We're seeing many of the unclaimed property issues being national now that could be to the detriment of Oregon. This will allow the Treasurer, through the NAST, National Treasurers Association, to take a leadership role there and increase visibility of the program. We're also pursuing selling isolated tracts of land. We've got 13 land sales that should bring in, we hope, around $500,000. And that announcement actually just went out within the last day that people will be bidding on that. And the isolated tracts that we're talking about are in Wheeler, Malheur, and Wallowa counties. We talked about the in-lieu lands. We're also planning an agency reorganization that not only includes the transfer of unclaimed property, but also creates a new land management division, has a waterway conservation division, which is the removal fill program, and finance and administration. Three new divisions from the current three divisions that we have. I think it will provide clear lines and put an emphasis on land management for the benefit of the Common School Fund. And then I also had talked earlier about the asset management plan. So that concludes my presentation. And I know there's a panel of a few people that would like to...
There are, and here we are. All right, well, thank you very much. I just have really enjoyed this, and I hope the committee and the members of the audience have as well. These are clearly valuable lands, and they help fund our schools. So thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to call you up in groups of three, Chuck Bennett, John Marshall, and Tricia Smith. all who have interests in making sure our common school fund produces well.
Madam Chair, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Madam Chair, I'll speak in behalf of all the beneficiaries you're going to hear from, kind of give you just a quick overview of where we are. First of all, congratulations. This is one of the first hearings an education committee has held on the Common School Fund that we're aware of. We've sort of put our heads together trying to figure out if an education committee has been through this in a long time, into the detail that you've gone. And we're just very pleased that you're taking an interest in this. We particularly want to thank and ask you to recognize the role that Director Hannes has played in our being here. Getting beneficiaries interested in a fund like this surprisingly has taken a long time and probably really hit its peak as the dollars hit about $40 million. And if we could look back 100 years and even 30 years, if beneficiaries had taken the interest that I think all of us are taking now, the history of this fund would have been substantially different. And the reason we are here is Ann Hannes has encouraged us, she has organized us, she has talked to us, she got us involved with all of us with a group involving representatives, education primarily, from 24 states, the Children's Land Alliance Supporting Schools, which was put together by a group of activists, parents, and education and educators in Utah, and we have been attending regular summer conclaves discussing these issues. We've been through these issues in enormous detail, I think all of us, and have become really fascinated, I think, like you have become, by the story of the Common School Fund and school lands. And it also, I think, has led us to kind of the motto we all operate on. It's the kids' money and it's the kids' land. And it is not the public's land. It is the kids' land. It belongs to the schools, and it's to the benefit of the schools. And there's an enormous misunderstanding out there as to the benefit of these public lands. With that in mind, we have been formed into a whole batch of beneficiary activities relative to the department. We have beneficiaries serving on the Grazing Fee Advisory Committee. We have an overall Beneficiaries Advisory Committee, serve on the Asset Management Plan Advisory Committee, a whole batch of activities. Only a session or two ago did we become active at all in the Department of State Lands budget and policy related bills. And last session I actually started attending the Ways and Means Subcommittee hearings on DSL, and some of the policy hearings we're hoping to show up more as a group this session and begin talking to the legislators overseeing DSL. We're hoping in the future that there will be a review among leadership of both the House and Senate as to the assignment of the bills relating to the division of state lands and the Common School Fund policy-related issues. It has been a tradition to assign these bills solely to natural resource committees. Certainly, as the discussion occurs around the division's activities, I can see how this has happened and why it's happened. But I found when I walked into those committees last session, there was a lot of "What are you doing here?" reaction. Well, we're here because there's a lot of money involved here. There is a fund that belongs to the kids of $900 million and growing, and we're very interested in how DSL is being managed. And only a small percentage of that money, or a large percentage, but certainly not the bulk of the money, is related to land management. The rest of it is a substantial fund management question, and there are a series of issues related to the management of that fund that we are real interested in. So we hope in the future education committees, revenue committees, particularly education committees, will have a chance to take a look at bills related to this, and particularly the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means rather than the solely to the Natural Resources Subcommittee. Madam Chair, this has just been a real interesting education for all of us, and I thank you again for the opportunity to let you know how well this is going.
Well, you're welcome, Mr. Bennett, and I want to thank Ms. Hannes, too. She wasn't in my office 5 minutes before I realized, oh, my gosh, this is something we have to have a hearing on. I asked her, and she was joyful about coming, and she had told me she had this advisory group, and I was just so impressed with her work and her involvement in bringing people in to manage what you say is a fund for the kids.
Yeah.
It's their land.
She's great. She's just great at doing this. She's gotten us all excited about something that I don't think any of us thought we'd get quite as excited. But we've had meetings where 30 of us. I know, you get this way. It's kind of a cult. You get the cult of the common school fund. You go to these meetings, and it really is very interesting.
I know.
It is a lot of fun.
We do need a life, but I am positively giddy. So
but something new under the sun, too.
It is.
Yeah.
All right. Do you have a question, Senator Moore?
Well, yes. I'd like to raise a question of the natural resources within the 3-mile limit on the land. I don't know if that's been looked at, but it certainly should, because there are resources on the ground under the water on that 3-mile limit, and if we're not getting some kind of a return on that, we're missing something, I would think.
Yeah, you're certainly right, Senator, and I think the one that Director Hannes mentioned is one that if you'd like to take up, I think it would give you a real feel for the kind of resistance that can occur as well, would be to take a look at those oyster beds and what happened 10 or so years ago when that was removed from part of our income base. There are other issues, and my colleagues will talk about them, but you're certainly hitting on the kind of things that are worth talking about in this area.
Thank you. And we've already hit our time limit, but I really want to hear from you. So a couple minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and we are a member of the Common School Fund. What do we call it? Beneficiary Advisory Coalition. Something.
Something like that.
Too many words for me to remember, but... We are very happy to be a part of that coalition because it fits very well with OSEA's effort to expand and enhance all areas of funding for our schools. We believe that for too long we have focused solely on the general fund allocation to schools to the detriment of all of the other funding sources that we have for schools. And the Common School Fund is a classic example of what can happen when a big pot of assets sits without us watching it. And it has diminished when we weren't watching it. And so we have committed ourselves to not only watch it, but try to educate the legislature to the value of this fund and the value of enhancing it as much as possible. You'll see bills coming from our group this session, and we hope you'll take a look at them. And we, as well as COSA and the other members, very much appreciate this committee's interest in the Common School Fund as a mechanism of funding schools in perpetuity. It's nice to think about this year's budget, and Lord knows we need to do that. But the Common School Fund is not just about this year's budget. It's about the budget for the school year for our great-grandchildren that we will never know. And so as we're protecting this year's budget and trying to do what we can with it, we hope that we're also enhancing the future of the Common School Fund for perpetuity. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. I don't think I can add much to what Chuck and Trish have already said, other than to point out the most important feature of all this, and that is the Common School Fund was created 146 years ago in the Oregon Constitution. And although our Constitution has been changed a number of times since then, this single piece has survived. And as Tricia suggests, while the debate has certainly heated over the last several days about the allocation to schools for the next 2 years, the things we do relative to the Common School Fund and our role in trying to preserve, protect, and defend Common School Fund lands and Common School Fund revenue will serve to benefit students way beyond the 05-07 biennium, and in fact benefit the kids that are in school today as well as their kids and their kids' kids. So I think we're going to be much more active players and was suggested we have some ideas to restore some revenue to the common school fund that's been lost. We're going to bring an idea to you that we believe will streamline and speed up the common school fund distributions from the Department of State lands to school districts. Now that follows those monies follow a rather circuitous route through county treasurers, which we believe is archaic and should go straight to the department for deposit into the accounts of school districts. So we have some ideas. Some will certainly be met with some opposition, but as Chuck suggested, the kids' money, and I think it's worth the fight.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We'll quickly call up Lori Wimmer Whalen and Andy Jordan.
Can't decide which chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen of the Oregon Education Association, also members of the Common School Fund Advisory Committee, and I will be very brief and just say that I echo everything our colleagues have said. We, too, thank the director of the DSL for involving us and keeping us apprised of bills as they come forward and issues that are ongoing. We, too, believe that it's time to keep an eye on the long-term investment, as is guaranteed by the Constitution. One of the bills that you will see come through very shortly is Senate Bill 845, which was requested by all of us who have come before you today. And this is our gift card bill. Right now, in many states, see uncashed gift card face value as unclaimed property. Oregon does not. And given that only about 40% of the face value of gift cards is ever cashed, this is a good opportunity both to provide a consumer protection of having a place to go for one-stop shopping, as it were, to collect your unclaimed property, and also in the meantime to be enable the Common School Fund to receive the interest off those holdings. And so we have a bill to ask the legislature to consider gift cards unclaimed property. And
great.
So
what just want to add that.
It's assigned to the Senate Revenue Committee, and it's, okay. It's a bipartisan bill. Two senators are sponsoring it.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Andy Jordan, and members of the committee, I am with the Oregon PTA. We, too, are also a member of the Beneficiary Advisory Coalition Committee. We're very pleased to participate and happy that the department and Director Hannes have been so wonderful in allowing us to participate. We participate in we attend the land board meetings. We also have a member sitting on the, and I'm not sure if I have this committee right either, it's the Grazing Range Land Fees Committee as well. So I would just like to echo our support for the movement that the department has been moving in protecting the funds and the for the kids. So thank you very much, and thank you for letting us have a word today.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thank you for coming down. And I just want to say for the record that Ms. Hannes came to my office on her own. This is what we like to see in our state employees. They are very proactive. She knew that I would probably have an interest in the Common School Fund, and she made that appointment to see me. I didn't call her because I didn't have a clue about this. I knew about the Common School Fund, but certainly not the history and the commitment that we've made in this state to the Common School Fund and what vital role it plays in educating and funding education in our state. So I just want to take this opportunity again to thank the department for their hard work and that you are able to participate in what we're trying to build here for our future.
And thank you, Madam Chair, for having this hearing. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. All right, with that, colleagues, I'm going to close the informational hearing. We're only 10 minutes behind schedule. It was well worth the delay. And we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 383. And would you like to tell us about that bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 383 allows students to refuse to participate or parents and legal guardians to refuse to allow a student to participate in dissection of an animal as a part of a public school course. However, the measure directs school districts to provide alternative materials or methods to demonstrate coursework competency. In your packet of information at your desk, you do have a letter of testimony from OHSU, as they are not able to participate in the hearing today. And I know that Representative Klomp is here.
Oh, she made it back.
Yes.
Oh, great. Okay. Could I hear from Representative Crump? I know she has to get off to a meeting. Welcome, and introduce yourself for us, please. Yes. Even though we know who you are.
Chair Walker and members of the committee, thank you for holding this hearing on Senate Bill 383. For the record, I'm State Representative Betty Comp, representing House District 22. I'm pleased to be testifying in support of a bill that I believe gives students and parents a choice in classroom curriculum that is against their core moral, personal, religious beliefs. The dissecting of animals can and does have physical and emotional consequences on students. As a public school administrator and teacher for 15 years, I have met with many students who really do not want to dissect or cut up animals, yet attempted to struggle through the lesson as part of the course requirement. We have many options for students in other curriculum areas they find objectionable, and animal dissection should be a similar choice. The technology is available for all schools to offer viable alternatives that demonstrate all aspects of biology that don't require a hands-on lesson. I urge your support in this legislation and would be happy to answer any questions that you have about students that I've had experience with that find this a very difficult thing to do, to dissect animals in classes.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Trump. Any comments from the committee? I think you're going to be joined by Senator Deckard, who is the sponsor of the bill.
Okay.
And if you need to leave to get off to your meeting, just go ahead and take your leave. Otherwise, we're happy to have you here.
Okay. Well, I just appreciate your time and your strong consideration for this bill.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have a dissection device right here.
After you identify yourself, you can talk to me about that.
I am Ryan Deckard. I'm a state senator from Beaverton and Southwest Portland and Alloa and a little bit of Hillsborough. You know what? I bet you Representative Comp made many of the points that I was going to make, so I'm not going to reiterate them. Other than a constituent came to me as a student who did not want to participate in this, and it seemed just to be a very logical and fair request that they made, that the state would give them some latitude if they didn't, for moral, religious, ethical reasons, want to participate. They should be able to opt out, like 11 other states. And I think one of the big issues that maybe Representative Comp didn't bring up, but I think it's certainly a valid one for us to consider, is the issue of litigation, because in other states they've litigated, and if you just drive up the huge cost of litigation, the Attorney General's office has to defend the state. And I think this is one, this bill would at least allow us to join the 11 other states that have allowed their students to the option of participating, and it's a well-crafted bill. And the other important thing that I should note on the record is, in terms of higher education and veterinarian and all of that world, we have no vision, or I certainly don't, with this bill. It really is for that student in K through 12 that, for whatever reason, would prefer not to participate in the dissection of an animal, and it just seems like a fair request to me that they have other options.
All right. Any questions? Senator Cruz?
I'm just curious as to why only two of the three bills before us today are Senator Decker's bills. I would have thought you'd have gone for a clean sweep, but
the third one I noticed does go to revenue, so
okay. Well, then
try back that.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Senator Deckard. You can join us back up here, and we will hear from. Do you want to do these two? Yeah. Why don't we bring Kelly Peterson up?
Good afternoon, Chair Walker and committee members. My name is Kelly Peterson, and I'm with the Humane Society of the United States. And on behalf of our 90,000 Oregon members and constituents, we're here to support Senate Bill 383. And really, this bill is, it's very simple. It just clearly would state and create a consistent policy statewide, just protecting kids or students who wish to refrain from dissection for whatever reasons that they articulate. This bill only affects K through 12 students, and I'd also like to say on the record that we don't have any intent in bringing any bill forward that would do something similar to higher education. Currently, approaches for dissection just vary from school to school and from teacher to teacher. So, as Senator Deckard had mentioned, states have already passed various bills dealing with dissection choice, including Louisiana, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Maryland. And students, really, they object for a variety of reasons, and this just simply creates a unified approach and just requires that students are notified in advance that they have a choice. And for me, though it was 22 years ago, I wasn't notified that I had a choice, and like most kids, I was incredibly shy, still am, very shy. And you'd think, as I, you know, lobby on animal protection issues, I still did not feel comfortable because my teacher didn't say to me, to the classroom, that if I'm uncomfortable, I could opt for another comparable alternative. So I ended up going through a dissection, and so I always look back now and I think, gosh, why wasn't I strong enough to say anything? But clearly in a classroom setting, oftentimes you are very worried about being embarrassed or, you know, getting a lower grade, all those things that you do when you're 15 or 16 years old. And I don't know. Maybe I'll leave at this point with some questions, but I do urge you to support Senate Bill 383.
The one question I have, Ms. Peterson, I don't know if you can answer or Senator Deckard, is, you know, I'm one of those kids also who refused to dissect an animal. I dissected a worm because I had to, an earthworm, and that was it for me. I was not going to the frog, and I was not going to the pig's head or anything else. So my school worked with me, Reedsport High School, and I did other things. My daughter's a vegetarian. She'd never dissect any living creature either. So let me ask, how many students, do you know approximately how many students we have in our state each year that go through this angst and want to do something as an alternative?
Chair Walker, I think that, you know, we have a broad membership. We have 90,000 members in Oregon. And we hear from members who are very young. Most of them, you know, they're not vegetarian. They just simply, they maybe have issues dealing with, you know, for whatever reason they've taken this position. But we have come in contact. We've also done surveys with the National Science Teachers Association Convention. And they've also revealed and indicated that they do come across it, and 66% of them support student choice. It is difficult to quantify. I would say there's probably, you know, two or three children, or maybe one or two children in each classroom. That, again, it's I don't have a number for you, but I certainly know, as someone who, you know, I went on to be a plywood broker, I wasn't involved in animal issues, but I was also someone who had pretty strong moral views on it. So I probably represent quite a few.
Great. Okay, thank you. Any questions from the committee?
I'm sure I just said I don't think the number is important.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's, if there's anyone who doesn't want to do it, they shouldn't have to. I think that sort of sends a message out there what this committee's thinking. Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Peterson. I appreciate your testimony. I'll hear from two people from Multnomah something or other. Paula Wilson and Courtney Dillard. Just says Multnomah on here. M-U-L-T. I assume that's Multnomah.
Yeah. That was me.
All right.
Let me start. Okay.
I'm Paula Ray Wilson, and I live in Portland. And Multnomah just means a resident of Multnomah County.
Okay.
But
I could have figured that out, but I'm a legislator. I'm a little slow.
My husband and I are both physicians. We have medical degrees from traditional medical schools. And our son is a 16-year-old sophomore at Lincoln High School who considers himself a serious science student. And he would very much like for there to be alternatives available to dissection. The point he asked me to make is he sees three groups of students in his biology class. Those who are serious about dissection and who want to participate, those who have ethical problems with participating, and a third group, which alarms him the most, which are people who have no interest in learning the science at all. So he considers it very wasteful when an animal is killed for this purpose and it's not used as it should be. So that was the point he asked me to make, that he thinks good alternatives should be available, and that it would also save money if the school didn't have to buy additional specimens. As a parent, I think I'm always in favor of alternatives, and because I think I know that for myself, being a passive recipient of education, I realized wasn't going to be good enough, and I've encouraged my son to be an active participant in his education. And whenever there's an option or a choice and parents discuss it, I think it's much more likely that people are actively involved in how they're going to learn anything, whether it's anatomy or mathematics or whatever. And as a person who has dissected animals, and my husband as well, we both discussed that we thought a lot of that was really unnecessary and we could have learned the material adequately with other resources. And particularly nowadays, I mean, my son in elementary school probably knew more about anatomy than I did in high school, because there are so many wonderful science books that and other materials that allow people to learn anatomy in this way. So, thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair Walker and committee members, my name is Dr. Courtney Dillard. I'm a professor at Willamette University, and I really came to testify today to talk about the power relationships in the classroom. Specifically, I think that this bill, it's quite a simple bill, basically has the teacher, before any kind of dissecting activities go on, informs the students, all of them, that there are alternatives. Now, for me, the point about this that's important is that it creates a more comfortable atmosphere for students who might not want to dissect. And the important thing is that in a classroom, the teacher represents the power structure. I know that because I'm a teacher every day in my classroom. And so when a student comes to me and has to kind of put the onus on themselves and say, I want to do something different, it's very different than if I put it out there in the beginning. So what I'm here to say is that someone might say, well, an individual teacher could make it, you know, make up their own mind to offer alternatives. Or an individual student might come and say, well, are there alternatives available? But this changes the power structure around so that the alternative is given legitimacy up front, and the student is given the opportunity to know about that alternative without having to seek out the teacher themselves. So it's just a shifting of the onus, the burden, as to who has to present the information. And as a result, I think it makes it more comfortable for the students. And in my experience, if students end up doing things that they don't want to do, they passively resist by not participating in the activity in the end, or participating in it half-heartedly, kind of having trouble throughout the process. So this kind of catches all of that at the get-go. And I just urge you to pass this out from committee. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for your perspective. Thank you both. Okay, Marcia Keith. And Marcia's the last person signed up to testify on this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcia Keith, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association to offer testimony on Senate Bill 383. I signed up as being neutral on the bill, and the OVMA, Oregon Veterinary Medical Association Board, has a couple of questions that have actually been referred to slightly in testimony so far, and then a concern that has also been addressed. So we are not here to oppose this bill. We are here to just explain and express some of the concerns that arose for us as we as a board discussed the bill. Our first question is, is, don't school districts already allow students to opt out of hands-on dissection? And I checked with some of my colleagues in the lobby who lobby for school districts and school boards and school administrators, and learned that, in fact, virtually all school districts allow students alternative methods when there is an objection to the hands-on dissection. Also, another question that was raised by our board is, where should the responsibility for establishing this policy lie? Should it actually be with the state, or should it lie with the school districts and the localities? But the major concern, and it was addressed, I was very pleased to hear both Senator Decker and Kelly Peterson assure the committee that the intention is only to address K through 12 students. The Oregon Veterinary Medical Association's concern regarding the ability to not work on real animals is a concern that has to do with preparation of people moving into veterinary school. As if the bill remains restricted to K through 12 from now until forever, then the bill is fine. There are so many alternative ways of enabling people to do dissection, to practice on live animals, that it's the Veterinary Medical Association's belief that it is a danger now and could continue to be a danger that people are ill-prepared for actually working on real animals when they enter veterinary medical school. So the assurance that we received from Senator Deckert and from Kelly Peterson is exactly, it answers our concerns, but we just need to go on record as saying we really do need to have university students prepared to enter a profession having worked on the real thing. So.
Thank you, Ms. Keith. And I think if anyone, by the time they get to college, has decided that they want to make veterinary medicine their career, that they know they're going to have to dissect something.
It would seem so, Madam Chair, although we had a couple of examples from members of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association Board who hired newly graduated veterinarians who had virtually no experience on real animals.
Mm. So. I can go into horse acupuncture.
Yeah, you could do that.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Ms. Keith. I am going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 325, and I'm, or no, 383, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 383. Do I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 383 to the floor to do best recommendation.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 383 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Just a comment based on the letter from OHSU and the fact that to some degree their research department has been under some strain from time to time, and this has no reflection on that, as was stated in testimony. This is quite simply giving some flexibility in the K-12 system. It does nothing more than that, and I think it's an appropriate move.
I agree. And Senator Deckert, I believe you've answered all the questions that were generated today and earlier.
I hope so.
Okay. All right. If there's no further discussion, is there any objection? And we don't need to call the roll. That bill is moving out of here. Senate Bill 383 has passed, and we'll go to the floor of the Senate. And Senator Decker, would you like to carry that?
Sure.
Great. Thank
we'll
you.
Ask the questions on the floor.
Oh, boy.
All right.
Read the bill then.
Okay. I think that would be a good idea. All right. We are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 325. We're going to hear first from Bob Cassidy, who is the person who is behind this bill.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 325 establishes a tax credit for employers who pay all or part of a community college tuition for their employees. However, the amount at this time is limited to $1,500, and it applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2007 through January 1st, 2011. This bill has a subsequent referral to revenue.
Thank you. And we have Senator Morissette joining us down below as the chief sponsor of this legislation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill Morissette, Senator Bill Morissette from Senate District 6, Lane and Lynn County, parts of. Madam Chair, I have been involved in this effort for the last two sessions, and I think it's a worthy effort, although it is a tax credit, which we have been struggling with. I think it has its balancing features, though, because it does allow an employer who cares about his or her employee enough to help them pay their college tuition. It's good for the employer to be able to do something positive for people that he cares about. It's good for the student to get some support outside of his family, perhaps, or her family and the institution. And it's good for the institution to fulfill a mission that they might otherwise not have access to. So with that, I will turn it over to Bob, who has been working on this diligently for the last two sessions. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Good afternoon, Mr. Cassidy.
Madam Chair, my name is Bob Cassidy from Eugene. This is what we're calling the Work to Learn Bill. The purpose of this bill is to take one more step in an effort to end the poverty cycle for some of our Oregon citizens. We are all aware that higher education has solved the cycle of dead-end jobs that lead to poverty and dependence on the dole. I see the problem, one of how to help some of these people get back into school. With this bill, an employer can offer an employee the opportunity and the encouragement to try to improve himself through the school environment. And I'd like to stress the word encouragement, because it means arranging hours and keeping track of that person, asking him how he's doing in school. He or she will be offered tuition payment and arrangement of school hours to foster this. Since most minimum wage earners are in the small businesses, the business sector of the state, and since most small businesses have few employees, the amount of tax credit is quite sufficient to give them a start. I suspect from the enthusiasm of the English as a second language department of the community colleges that this credit may be used by many for this subject. My hope is that others may begin to seek a new and more bountiful career. We will need some time to get the word of this bill out to the small businesses, so the effective date of this is 2007 and sunsetting 4 years later. As a result, the impact of this bill will be in the next legislative session. The Legislative Revenue Office estimated that in the 2003 session that the cost to the state for this bill would be $45,000 for the first year and rising steadily to about $90,000 in the fourth year. If it seems like this bill is well received by the business community and students, we will be back in 4 years to extend it with detailed information of its value and actual cost to the state. Your approval of this bill would be most appreciated. I had arranged for a small business person in Eugene to come here. He was telling me that he had an employee that would be an excellent candidate, and he wanted to talk about that. He was unable to due to sickness. And I have heard from the superintendent of schools office, the assistant to Susan Castillo, indicated that they were working on a letter to approve this also.
Okay. Mr. Bischoff, are you here?
Madam Chair, I'm Don Bischoff, Legislative Assistant to Senator Morissette. I'm just here to lend some moral support to Bob and answer any technical questions that might come up.
Madam Chair, I think he did a very good job of adding moral support.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Senator Stern, did you have a question?
A comment. I talked to Mr. Cassidy earlier today, and I'm enthusiastically in support of this bill. I think it's an excellent idea. I think it will help small business. I think it'll help students who are trapped in dead-end jobs and or young people. And so I'd like to see this moved over to revenue and have a chance to vet it in the process.
Oh, yeah, it does go to revenue. I thought it was Ways and Means, but it is revenue. We need that. If I was listening, yes.
Which is a committee that's still meeting, I believe.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Senator Starr. Thank you, Mr. Cassidy. Appreciate your coming. And Mr. Bischoff, you're always welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. I have two other people signed up to testify. One is neutral, one is against. I'm going to bring you both up at the same time for time constraints. Ed Glad and Susan Boyanovsky. Ooh, I think I got that right. That's a beautiful last name.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Boyanovsky. I'm an instructional development specialist with the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. I'm happy to and honored to provide you some testimony for this bill on behalf of Camp Ross-Brawley. The agency has reviewed the bill and is neutral on it. Community colleges already have billing processes in place. They've got an infrastructure to handle third party billing between students, the employers. There's a couple ways they do this. They have a student takes a class, the college bills the employer. Another way they do this is through a reimbursement process. A student earns, say, a C or better, takes their grades to their employer, and the employer reimburses the student. So the community colleges already have an infrastructure to handle this third-party billing. Another point that I would like to mention is that this could conceivably shift demand or increased demand. The report that you see was prepared by the Oregon Employment Department, Brenda Turner, and she identified three industries that could be impacted based on the criteria of the bill: leisure and hospitality, retail trade, and natural resources. With all this in mind, if there is an increase on our 17 community colleges, it's going to be a need for more classes. And right now, we've lost between the years 2001 and 2003, we've lost 4,700 classes. And basically, this is because of lack of, you know, state revenues. So you have to kind of have the chicken and the egg kind of thing. With that, we are neutral, and I thank you for the opportunity of providing this testimony to you.
Thank you. Question by Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I understand the constraints, the budget constraints community colleges are under, and I'm hoping we can do something this session to correct that, because I think it's atrocious personally, but I guess this is a method of allowing people who may not otherwise be able to access community colleges to do it. So I guess I'm confused as to why you'd be neutral when it increases opportunity.
We believe that this is another opportunity for providing low-income workers an opportunity to gain skills and knowledge so they can advance up the career ladder is. But the reality with the colleges is we're already cutting classes because we don't have the resources to find faculty and keep those classes going. So we're in the middle on this one.
More classes, more money, more teachers. To them. Yeah. Okay. Mr. Glad.
My name is Ed Glad. I work for the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, and I am a carpenter. I've been a carpenter for over 25 years. We have concerns about this bill with regards to the community college's support of apprenticeship programs that are an alternative track for non-union apprentices to enter into the workforce. And of the concerns that we have is when these community college programs began, a number of our members were pointing out that our program is 100% paid for by both the employers and the workers, and that includes all of our facilities, all of the materials, all of the curriculum development, the instruction, as well as if somebody has to take a class in Portland but they live in Klamath Falls or in Roseburg, we will pay for their travel to get to Portland and for their overnight stay for the week that they're there. So we have a tremendous investment in the apprenticeship and the development of the workers in the construction industry, in the carpenter, millwright, pile drivers, and drywall industry. When these programs began at the community colleges, we felt that there was a very reasonable complaint or problem to say that the government, the state government, is actually subsidizing with facilities on their property, with curriculum development, with the subsidizing of the teachers, and at the same time we were seeing students that would leave those programs and come back over into the union side and want to get jobs, but they would have to start their apprenticeship all over again because they were very ill trained. In fact, these apprenticeship programs were turning out no more than 28% of their entrants into journeymen, whereas the union apprenticeship programs are turning out 86%. One of the core reasons why that happens is that in the union apprenticeship programs, the apprentices are basically working side by side in a multi-employer environment. When they enter in apprenticeship on the other side, on the non-union side of the industry, they enter in obviously on a multi-employer, but the commitment from employer to employer to that worker becomes less involved. So they are unable to continually interact with mentors to be able to put in perspective why it is so difficult to work in the middle of the winter on a bridge, you know, in the middle of the mountains, or in the middle of the summer in Lakeview when the mosquitoes are eating them alive. That mentoring is a very critical part. But at the same time, their wages have been suppressed. And so here's the rub that we see in this particular bill, on top of that it's a state-subsidized program, is that we are afraid that there will be employers who will take advantage of this minimum wage to 50 cents above minimum wage clause and continue to suppress the workers' wages so that they can get that tax break. And when that happens, how long will the young people who enter those apprenticeship programs stay in the business so that we can replenish the industry as a whole, not union or non-union, but the industry as a whole, so that the workforce is available when we get to the part where there's a needed draw on that particular sector of the workforce. So, for example, we now are looking at 10 or 11 years out to finish the bridge projects that the state of Oregon has said we are going to invest our money in that. If the mean average of workers in the construction industry is above 42, 10 years from now, we're saying that we expect the construction industry to supply those workers that are going to be working out in the sun, in the winter, in the summertime, and in the snow in the wintertime. And it's not realistic to be able to keep that particular workforce going when we have disincentives for people to stay in it because employers are taking the incentive to keep the wages low. So it's a little bit difficult reasoning, but I suggest that if you took out the apprenticeship programs, that we would not have any beef with this. I am a big supporter of education. And just to illustrate that, my oldest son, he went off to college. I went off to college. My second son is turning 18 on Friday, and he's going into apprenticeship. And he had better SAT scores than both his dad and his older brother, but he wants to go into apprenticeship because he sees the value of what his father's experience was. I don't have any problem with encouraging people to go to college, or and especially people who find themselves in the lowest end of our industries in their pay scales. But if you could exempt these apprenticeship programs from this bill, you wouldn't hear from me again. Thank you. I'd answer any question on this.
All right. Any questions from the committee?
Well, thank you, Mr. Glad. I think your objections notwithstanding, I'm getting the sense the committee wants to move the bill to revenue, which will give the proponent, Senator Morissette, time to work with you if he thinks that adjustment needs to be made. So I think that's where we're going to be today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for testifying. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 325. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 325. Do I hear a motion?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 325 to revenue. But I do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 325 to revenue with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
We did have an opportunity to discuss the concerns of Ed Glad. And I don't see if we didn't have time to do an amendment because we figured if the bill did move, and it apparently is, that there would be time to do that. I don't see the connection necessarily between the apprenticeship program and the students in general. I don't know if it would make any difference to remove the apprenticeship program. I don't see that as a problem. I think the important thing is that small employers such as Bob would have an opportunity to do something good for the people that work for them. So I don't see this as a conflict, and we will continue that discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? All right, well, I suspect you will continue that discussion, and you can have it over in Senator Deckard's committee. No further discussion. We don't need to call the roll because there is not an objection won today. So that bill passes and goes to revenue. Close the work session. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 467. Colleagues, it's 4:45. We have quite a few folks signed up to testify, so I will take this committee till 5:30. If you have to leave because you have other obligations, please feel free to do so, because I did not let you know in advance we would stay late. I believe there's food outside?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay, that makes it even more exciting to stay here till 5:30. So I think, Senator Deckard, this is your bill. You want to take a seat in front of us, and Representative Debbie Farr as well.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 467 requires the Department of Education to reimburse school districts, government agencies, and community groups for lunches that are served during the summer as a part of the Summer Food Service Program or the National School Lunch Program. There is money that is appropriated from the general fund to the Department of Ed for reimbursement of the lunch program, and this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Oh, great.
And, by the way, Senator Deckard's testimony was handed out with his previous bill.
Okay.
So you might find it associated with Senate Bill 383.
All right. I have it. Thank you. Senator Deckard, do you want to defer to the representative?
Thank you.
Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Debbie Farr. I'm State Representative in House District 14. And I'm here to talk with you about Senate Bill 467. The problem is that Oregon continues to be one of the hungriest states in the nation. Nearly 1 in 5 children in Oregon lives in a food insecure home. Thousands of low-income children are able to access free and reduced-price lunches during the school year. Unfortunately, during the summer months, only 19% of children eating free and reduced-price lunches during the school year eat free meals during the summer. And I want to stop there. These obviously are printed talking points, and I want to talk with you about my personal experience with the summer lunch program. Fairfield Elementary School, which is in the Bethel School District, located in my house district, is a site that serves summer lunches. As a former Fairfield staff member, I am well aware of the number of students that eat free and reduced price lunches each day, and now it's up to 75%. Marilyn Martin, who's the principal of Fairfield, spoke to me recently about a child who came to her in tears because
that day there was a half day at school, and they knew that they wouldn't be eating again until the next morning at breakfast. So you can imagine that's one day without food, but we're talking about vacations and summers where children don't have access to breakfast and lunch. What this bill would allow is more children to be served. And I also want to tell you about an experience that I had last summer working at a Food for Lane County site at Peterson Barn, which is also in my district. And what they do is serve kids who really, it's a gap that occurs between the time that school ends and the time the summer lunch program begins. And Food for Lane County has stepped in and has been willing to fill in that period of time by providing food. I served food. There were over 100 kids that came through the line that day. The great thing about that program is they not only serve the education community, kids who are in school, but they also serve their little brothers and sisters. And I was quite amazed to see how many children there were that would not have had lunch that day if we hadn't served them a sack lunch. And it wasn't a glamorous lunch. It was a sandwich, some vegetables, some fruit, and milk. But they were very happy to have it. So I urge you to take Senate Bill 467 to the floor for a vote. I am in favor of feeding kids, and I think that we all are. So thank you for letting me talk with you today.
Thank you. Senator Deckert.
Madam Chair, Ryan Deckert, Senate District 14. You know, I'm going to get out of the way of the folks behind me because we have a short amount of time, and it's really the Hunger Relief Task Force, the Food Bank, Children First, and others who have brought this program to us. But the one thing that I would say is it was one of the real successes working with former Representative Farr that we accomplished last session. We leveraged $2.5 million in federal funds, and when you leverage federal funds, this all came in the form of the sandwiches and the vegetables that make such a difference to a seven-year-old that's hungry in the summer. And so to me, we work on a lot of important stuff, but to me this is actually ranks right up there with the very important stuff because it's a livelihood issue for these kids. And if we can bring in more federal dollars with a very tiny state investment, and pleased to hear that this time we were fighting to get into a tough budget last time with new money and a new idea. This time the programs work so well that we're actually down in Ways and Means, we're there. And so as soon as this bill hopefully gets there, we've been included in the Department of Education's budget. They've seen how it's worked, and so we're in much better position this time than we were last time, and pleased last time that the Ways and Means Committee saw the value of this, took a chance, and said we want to get those federal dollars in here, and we want to help these children that have a very, very tough time, as Representative Farr mentioned, making it through that July, August, September, being food insecure. And amazingly, it's one out of every five kids in Oregon that finds himself in that position.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to call up Pat Farr now, former state representative. And I didn't call you up with your wife because I wanted her to have a chance to shine at the dais without you, and she did very well.
Madam Chair, she shines even when she's with me.
Well, I suspect that as well, too. So now that you're here, former Representative Farr, why don't you talk to us about your good work on this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee, senators. Former colleagues. My name for the record is Citizen Pat Farr. I am from Eugene, Oregon, Northwest Eugene. I am the Executive Director of Food for Lane County. I'm also a member of the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force. It's good to speak first because then you don't repeat something that some other people have had. And having sat in those chairs as many days as I have, I know that repeating testimony is something that can be particularly boring, shall we say. The other thing I'm going to do is something that I really appreciated when I was on the Education Committee in the House last session and on the Revenue Committee in the House last session. I'm going to be very brief. Not necessarily, in fact, I've already gone longer than I thought I was going to. Food for Lane County operates the largest summer lunch program in the state. This last summer we served between 3,000 and 3,500 kids a day, something in the neighborhood of 130,000 meals, hot meals during the summer. And I took time serving, and the kids really appreciate this. Now, Food for Lane County has a very well-developed summer lunch program, the best-developed one in the state. And so this bill really does less for us than it does for some of the parts of the state that have less developed systems, particularly in rural Oregon, where many school districts or school district zones don't have any summer lunch programs at all. Now, we serve about 3,000 to 3,500 kids a day, but we're just scratching the surface of the kids who, during the school year, qualify for free or reduced lunch programs. The other thing is the USDA requirements cause us to put our 55 sites that we operate in Lane County in places where a certain percentage of the kids in that area qualify for free or reduced price lunch. So what that does is in the more affluent areas, and I'll use the city of Cobourg as an example, where only 20% of the kids, I believe about 20%, qualify for free and reduced lunch, we're not able to put a summer lunch site there because, you know, most of the kids don't qualify. Most of the kids are receiving adequate food at home. But what does that do for the other 20% of the kids? So this bill for us at Food for Lane County would allow us to penetrate into areas where kids who still are living in poverty, still are qualifying for the lunch program, are able to access summer lunches. Now, one thing that a heartbreaking story for me is I had a couple of kids that I was talking to not long ago who told me that they hate summer break. You know, my kids, when they were growing up, I mean, they counted down the days to summer break, and they hate summer break because they don't get to eat during the summer, and it's a pretty heartbreaking situation when you hear people who are so different to the kids that, you know, that I raised. Once again, Food for Lane County does have a very well-developed system. We operate lots and lots of different programs. Food for Lane County will distribute someplace between 7 million and 8 million pounds of food this year, which is a staggering amount of food. It's a semi-truckload or more every single day. So allowing Food for Lane County to reach into areas that aren't being served currently. Hunger is an issue that some people understand, many people do not understand. How can Oregonians be hungry? Well, there are lots of reasons. The people that we serve and the kids that we serve, you know, you think, who are the parents of these kids? Are they bums? Are they deadbeats? Are they homeless? That's not the case, by and large. By and large, it's what we classify as the working poor, people who pay their taxes, pay their transportation fees, pay their rent, which you have to do, and come toward the end of the month, they don't have money to put food on the table. So, you know, that's who we're serving. And the myth that it's, you know, deadbeats and bums and meth addicts, of course, you know, some people qualify in those areas, but by and large, it is the working poor that we're serving. And this Senate bill, should it go through, is going to help not only Food for Lane County, but places that aren't being served currently. And that's what it's all about. I appreciate you taking my testimony, and if you have any questions, which I doubt you do, I'd be willing to stay for a few moments more and answer.
Thank you, Mr. Farr. I think we're all pretty convinced about the hunger issue in Oregon. We need to feed these children. It's a tragedy. It truly is.
When I saw the makeup of this committee, I thought, whew.
That's an easy
one. Come on.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I'm going to hear from one, two, these three? Yeah. Joyce Dougherty, Tina Kotek, and Ellen Lowe. Why don't all three of you come up at once?
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joyce Dougherty, and I'm the director of the Child Nutrition Programs in the Office of Finance and Administration, the Department of Education. The child nutrition programs include the National School Lunch, the school breakfast, the child and adult daycare, child and adult food programs, and the summer food service program. This bill impacts children and the summer food service program sponsors. The Department of Education supports Senate Bill 467, ODE's 2005-2007 agency request budget included a policy package number 107, which requests $150,000 for the summer lunch program. In addition to the federal meal reimbursement, Senate Bill 467 will provide an additional 5 cents reimbursement to summer food service sponsors. I want to provide a little bit of background in terms of how we got to where we are with Senate Bill 467. It started last legislative session with Senate Bill 287, which was passed during the 2003-2005 legislative session. $49,000 was appropriated to the Department of Education for reimbursement to summer food sponsors in extremely low-income areas. Senate Bill 287 charged the Oregon Department of Education with 3 activities. One was to reimburse school districts and community groups located in very low-income areas, income areas in which 85% or more of the students are eligible for free or reduced-price meals. The second activity of Senate Bill 287 was to convene an advisory group to support the summer food service programs and make recommendations, which included a request to the 73rd Legislative Assembly for an increase of the current appropriation. The committee met twice during the 2003-2004 and made the following recommendations: that the state of Oregon should contribute 5 cents per meal or snack for each meal or snack that is served during the summer months to help stabilize existing programs, improve meal quality, and encourage new sponsorships throughout the state. The second recommendation of the advisory committee was to expand the state reimbursement to all summer food service meal programs and to set the rate at 5 cents per meal. Now, this is again in addition to the 85% areas in which students are eligible for free or reduced price meals. The recommendations were based on cost effectiveness of using a rate per meal system and offering more financial flexibility to all sponsors and making it easier for ODE to administer the program. The third activity for ODE was that we would submit a report on the study and the recommendations of the advisory group to the interim committees on education no later than October 1, 2004, and that committee is on the attachment. That report is in the attachment that I sent you. The 5 cents a meal lunch will make a difference to summer food sponsors. It will help improve the quality of meals. It will help with sponsors to outreach to children, and it will also help increase the number of sponsors that are able to participate. It will help increase the number of sites and also the number of children that may be served. Sponsors can use these funds to purchase equipment that would facilitate or enhance food service. It would help staff sites or other expenses that would be allowed, that are allowed by the federal government for child nutrition programs. Based on our calculations, each sponsor would receive an approximate, and this is an average, for an additional $700 per sponsor. Some would receive less, some would receive more. This bill does not supplant federal funds. It supplements the federal meal reimbursement to summer food sponsors for lunch meals. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Doherty. Did you have any questions? All right.
I want to say thank you to the department. They've been good to work with since we started this process 2 years ago. I appreciate their support on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tina Kotek. I'm the policy director at Children First for Oregon.
Thank you for the opportunity today to speak in support of 467. Children First for Oregon is a nonprofit organization. We work on issues that affect the well-being of children and families across the state. We have made 467 a priority because we worked on the bill last session, and we also know that we have far too many hungry children in this state. Last session was a victory for our kids in Oregon. I believe it was unanimously passed by both chambers last session to put a little bit of state general fund into supporting sites across the state who offer the federal summer food program. Up until last session, Oregon was one of the only states that didn't put state general fund into supporting that program. So we rectified that last session, and we had the advisory committee. We participated in that committee, and the discussion was all the sites need some support from the state. They're doing great work in their communities, making sure that children who depend on those meals during the school year are not left out without anything to eat during the summer months. It's a very important program. It's a priority bill for us this session, and we are very appreciative of Senator Deckard and all of you, actually, who voted on the bill last session as well. I think when we have 19% of the children who, only 19% of the kids who eat during the school year are eating during the summer, that's a huge gap to fill. And this really becomes a school readiness issue because we know hunger is a huge risk factor for kids in terms of their ability to learn and stay healthy. That's why this concept to put more money into the summer food program is a priority for the Healthy Kids Learn Better Coalition. The folks who work in the education community and the human services community know that children need to eat all year round so they can learn all year round and be ready for school in the fall. So we hope that you will support this bill, move it over to Ways and Means. We think it's very important for our kids this session. Thanks.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Lowe.
Chair Walker and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, legislative advocate for the Oregon Food Bank, and I'll try to keep my remarks short because they could be very long on this issue. I wear a button that some of you may not be able to read. Hunger doesn't take a vacation. Hunger doesn't take a vacation. And it, I wear it so people will ask about it. And I remember 20 years ago when I discovered that the heaviest month at the food bank where I volunteered was July. It was a real surprise to me. And then I began to ask some questions and discovered that these were families coming in. Their children were eating lunch at school during the school year. There was nothing like this that was available for them in the summer. The 870 food agencies that are part of the Oregon Food Bank, they're seeing now that often half of the people coming in are families with children. And so they endorse the need for a program such as this, and they seek your endorsement also. Also, many of the people involved in food pantries, most of them really, are volunteers. And so they are part of programs and sponsorships that are also part of summer food. And so for me, one of the real advantages in expanding this, and I would say it's a value-added component of summer food, happens to be the programs then that wrap around the summer food, because it's recreation, it's sports, it's science, it's art, it's music, and these really then become part of what I would call extended learning, socialization, and sometimes just fun for kids. And so it gives them a sense of the hospitality that the community is there offering them. And so, as others have said, the food is going to build their growth in their bodies and in their brains. But I would say that the activities that are really around summer food also are going to build their concept of what hospitality really means, what community is. And so I think the benefits are going to far outreach what we do in terms of the value of the food. And I want to echo the thanks to the department, because I have seen such growth and change. I go to their website, and it's exciting. And I thank you, Senator Decker. Last session, I said that I wore out my knees begging a certain chair of a House Rules Committee to hear that bill. And so I don't think I'll have to do that this time. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Ms. Lowe. Thank all of you for your testimony. We appreciate it. We've got three other folks to testify. I'll have you come up all at once. See, Noreen.
Go to House Rules.
Copeland, I think. Philip Kennedy Wong and Cynthia Hanna. Hope I did that right.
Well, it goes to Ways and Means. So that go to Substantive Committee.
It goes to my committee in Ways and Means.
Right, but it won't go to the Substantive Committee on that.
No, probably not. This thing. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Noreen Goughlin.
Oh, Goughlin.
I'm a resident of Welch's, Oregon, and I'm the lead convener of a fairly new organization called the Oregon Faith Roundtable Against Hunger. Concerned about the levels of hunger experienced by Oregonians, this roundtable was formed just in 2003. To seek ways in which the faith community can help address and find some of the solutions that people in the state are to the issue of hunger. In the past year, we've become a gathering of almost 400 hunger advocates representing about 18 faith communities, and have now roundtables in Lane County, in Salem, in Portland Metro, and in Astoria. We recognize that hunger will be most effectively be addressed by several of the major communities within Oregon: the business community, the faith community, the wider community, and particularly in its lead role, the state of Oregon. The summer food program is a key stabilizing force for families who struggle to provide food for their children. In October 2004, Governor Kulongowski hosted an interactive teleconference in 10 sites throughout Oregon, taking a look at childhood nutrition with a heavy emphasis on those programs provided through our educational systems. Members of our roundtable were active in all 10 sites and indeed were facilitators in some of the local dialogues. I was able to participate at the Astoria site. I must tell you that the people of the North Coast know their community very well and are very committed to finding solutions to hunger for the children of that community. They're also aware that there is now a loss of grants that help to provide some of the supportive services and transportation for kids to participate in the summer food programs. They were amazed that areas such as Napa had been overlooked when they reviewed the state list provided by the Department of Education of communities where 50% or more children either qualified for free lunch or reduced meals. Because they know Napa, and they know the economic condition of many of the families who live in that community. They also are active in reviewing their community's assets, seeking appropriate partnerships that can assure that children can have a regular, sustainable food source through the summer. The statistics that they reviewed are indeed shocking. And I know you recently, just in the last few minutes, received the list of eligible schools. The school in my own neighborhood, 39% of the children qualify. Washington County, Barnes Elementary, 70.23%. Cornelius Elementary, 80.98%.
in Josephine County, Evergreen Elementary School, 77%. Lorna Byrne Middle School, 76.94%. I really encourage you to take a look at the schools that are in the communities that you know so well, and feel what that means as you review it. There are many potential partners in Oregon to help us address this and to hunger, but also to help support the summer food programs. But the leadership of the state is essential in providing resources to the school districts and the community programs to assure that young lives are supported. I must tell you, I left very early for the Valley, a day of work in the Valley. As I left, I stopped on Welch's Road because of those flashing red lights of that yellow school bus. And I saw 10 kids kind of clamber aboard. And my first thought was, which four are hungry? And of the 10, what will summer mean if there isn't a summer food program? I personally really encourage your support and very glad to see the level of support that this bill and this issue has in this session. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kennedy Wong.
Chair Walker and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Philip Kennedy Wong with EML. That's Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. We are the State Association of Churches. I'm here actually wearing a couple different hats. I've been asked by Patty Whitney Weiss, who is the Executive Director of the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and also Bob Castanian with the Oregon Catholic Conference, to send their support and their message of Senate Bill 467. Both of them could not be here today. I'll be very brief. A lot of what's been said we share in terms of our support for it. What you did receive in front of you is a list of the potential schools that would qualify for this program. And if I counted correctly, I think there's 486 schools, and this is as of May 2004, that would be eligible for this program. Speaking primarily for EMO and also just in general faith-based social services, the summer food program would augment the existing emergency food programs that a lot of churches and faith-based nonprofits have and operate throughout the state of Oregon. And what this would do, it would help to relieve some of the pressure and load that these faith-based social service emergency food programs experiences, much like what Ms. Ellen Lowe indicated earlier. But most importantly, one of the things that we see in terms of this program is it does augment a family's household food budget, which is very critical because when you think about it, when a child goes to school, that parent doesn't have to worry about providing meals, at least for lunch, and some of them maybe also be receiving the breakfast program as well. So when you add that to the cost to a family household budget for food in the summer, it does add up, which may mean that there are some children that are going without food. The one great thing about this program that we applaud is that one of the sites for some food program could be churches. And obviously, you know, that is something that we are very supportive of because we believe that churches do play an anchor role within our communities, and to the extent where people can come to a church and recognize that it's a place where not only that they can get fed, they can also receive other services that churches may be connected to. And with that, I conclude my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Hanna. I'm here as a community member, but I'm also a parent. I'm a student. I'm working an internship currently with the Multnomah County Commission on Children, Families, and Community. And last summer, during my internship, I did outreach and surveys with the Summer Food Program. And what I found doing the surveys and the outreach is that access is a very important issue. A lot of people weren't accessing the program that wanted to because there weren't enough sites, or the services at the sites were not adequate
to the demand. Another thing that I found was that the activities played a very big part in participation of the children in the actual summer food program. It was a very important component, and it gave the children positive activities, positive environment, and positive role models also. The lack of outreach and the lack of access is something that I'm hoping to address in my internship this coming summer, and I've been really excited about this bill for that reason, because I'm hoping to be able to do more outreach and reach more families with news about this program. There's not a lot of awareness out there. In Multnomah County, only 22% of the children were served that qualify for free lunch programs during the school year, and that is a very big gap that I would really like to have an opportunity to fill. Personally, I have accessed the summer lunch programs for my children when they were younger and when the programs were accessible to me, and it was very helpful. It was something that I considered to be a lifesaver, because I was on food stamps, and during the school year I didn't have to worry about feeding my children lunch. During the summer I couldn't worry about it because I didn't have the ability to do that. Food stamps aren't increased during summer simply because your kids aren't eating that free lunch. So it really created a major hardship for me, and especially for my children. So it's a very important program. It's very worthwhile. As Ellen said, hunger doesn't take a vacation, and our children deserve to eat. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hannah. That last comment you made about your food stamps are not increased in the summer when your kids don't get the free lunch, I've never thought about that before, and you're absolutely right. The food stamps are based on your income level, not on whether your child is at home anymore or at school. So
right.
That's a very, very good point that you made. Senator Starr, you had a question?
A comment. I had an opportunity a few years ago to meet this witness. We got a chance to walk a mile together. I'll tell you that she's one wonderful mother who's worked very hard to provide for her children and to advance her own education and opportunity in this world, and I want to commend her. It was a pleasure to meet her and her children and have that opportunity with them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Starr, for participating in that program. Well, I think that's a really awesome program, and I've not had an opportunity to do that, but I've enjoyed reading about people's experience doing that, and I'm so glad that you were able to do that. All right, thank you all very much. I appreciate your testimony. Senator Starr, do you have a motion for me by chance? Oh, wait a second. I'm closing the public hearing. I'm opening the work session, and now I let you have a motion. I'm so glad we have Marjorie here.
I move Senate Bill 467 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Starr moves this bill to Senate Bill 467 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? All I can say is I'm happy to have that down in Ways and Means. Any objection? None heard. So this bill is moving to Ways and Means. I close the work session on Senate Bill 467. I thank everyone for staying late once again, and the participation on this committee is wonderful. We are adjourned.